The Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project was produced in association with the 3rd Annual Institute of African Studies Conference and FESHRIFT in honor of Linda Freeman, Solidarity and Shifting Patterns of Hegemony in Southern Africa, Historical and Contemporary Perspectives, which was held on March 1st and 2nd, 2018, at Carleton University. This Oral Histories Project consists of interviews with participants of the conference, including activists, aid workers, diplomats, and politicians, who volunteered to discuss their personal experiences as part of the anti-apartheid movement in Canada. The interviews were conducted by Susan Bazilli, PhD student at the University of British Columbia, and by myself, Michael Buchert, a PhD student at Carleton University. In this interview, Jim McKinnon sat down with me to talk about his experiences working with Oxfam Canada. This was recorded on February 28th, 2018 at Carleton University.
My name is Jim McKinnon. I worked with Oxfam Canada for 25 years. I finished work with them in June of 2015. And I worked as program manager for Southern Africa for a very long time. I was also the country representative in Zimbabwe for 3 years.
When did you first learn about the situation facing South Africa, and what shaped your opinion about it?
First heard about South Africa when I was 19 years old, growing up in Calgary. I heard mostly about, at that time, Zimbabwe. At that time, it would have been Rhodesia. And a funny little story on it was that in April 18th, actually 1980, when the Rhodesian flag was lowered at midnight and the Zimbabwe flag was raised and Robert Mugabe was standing right beside Prince Charles. And I always ask the question, do you know who came on stage and played for 2 hours? Bob Marley. So he played at Rufaro Stadium for 2 hours. The stadium was packed and there was twice as many people outside of the stadium. I had heard about this and I wanted to learn more. So in a sense, that's how I found out about Southern Africa, through a more of a cultural event than a political event.
Right.
And I ended up going to Zimbabwe 4 years later. And at that time, in beginning of 1985, I lived there for 3 years in rural Zimbabwe, and we never went to South Africa because it was just part of, it was apartheid. It was probably some of the worst years that were going on in South Africa at the time. And it was a real split between the expats that were living in Zimbabwe. Some were going down to buy nice goods and things like that, and a lot of the rest of us politically decided not to do it. But just to step back a little bit, so then in 1982, when I moved to Montreal and went to McGill, I joined the anti-apartheid network at that time, and I sat as on the Senate. At that time, we were debating and passing around divestment. And we were able to convince, I was on the Senate for 2 years, to be able to convince the university to divest. And it was the major campaign on universities, on major universities across Canada at that time.
And if I'm correct, the university didn't take up that recommendation for a few years.
No, they didn't. It took them a long time. Well, there was basically two major sort of solidarity networks that were happening at that time. One was around Central America, and the other one was around Southern Africa, and was anti-apartheid. Mm. And this was a major one to be able to actually have real concrete actions, and one of them was divestment. And universities, almost all of them, were extremely reluctant to begin with, but eventually did come under. They did actually do it, but it took a long time. And it was probably the best example of real mobilizing at a university. It was at that time, I don't remember many other issues. It wasn't as politicized. It was, now there's a lot more issues. At that time, there was just, it seemed from my memory that was the major issue. And there was nobody, because even at that time, I think it was in 1983, Ian Smith ex-president, you know, prime minister of Rhodesia tried to speak at McGill, and we lobbied against it, and we got him to not speak. Because he was going to get, I think if I remember right, about $6,000 as a token, right, as a whatever they call it, to pay for speakers. And we rallied against it and got, I remember, thousands of people actually out to be able to say, no, we're not allowed to do this. This is, he's a racist and thing and all of that. So.
Wow. What kind of other activities were being taken by the anti-apartheid movement at that time?
Well, at that time, see, I think there was basically two, I think, sectors. No, probably three. One was on the campuses, and there was anti-apartheid groups, and in all of, that way I understood at the time, would have been right across the country. There was also then the academics, certain academics. I don't really remember one being at McGill, but, you know, there was, you know, academics in at Queen's. I remember ones at Ottawa, you know, across the country. And they were speaking out. So there was that side. And then there was the civil society. There were the NGOs and the churches and the trade unions. And they were organizing, and you'll be interviewing a number of them, that they organized in a very interesting way, that students sometimes got involved in them, with them. I remember later when I started working with Oxfam that, you know, we would tap into the student movements, but they were just another one of the groupings that were in the anti-apartheid network. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very extensive across the country. Mm-hmm. And it was a very interesting, when I came back from Zimbabwe in 88, and I moved back to Montreal, and I got involved in a radio show, actually, at McGill, and I hosted a radio show for a year around, and it was basically an anti-apartheid, with myself and a Zimbabwean guy, and we brought on music, and we did interviews, and we did all of that, and it was a very interesting time, because it was still very heavy repression that was going on in South Africa, but you could, it was starting to see some breaks in this. Mandela was off of Robben Island, and you knew that there were some sort of talks going on, but we still at that time thought we're at least 10 years away. And so then I moved up to Ottawa to do my graduate degree at the University of Ottawa, and I started volunteering with Oxfam, and then got a job, and it was all on Southern Africa. So I entered the anti-apartheid movement, mm-hmm. From a paid position, which was actually very, very nice, and very, it was an interesting, I hadn't seen that side of it. Mm-hmm. I'd seen it from a volunteer side, mm-hmm. and from a student activist side, and then I saw it from a rural Zimbabwe side, because one of the issues that was really quite poignant for me is 1986, and I was in the little township, well, calling it a township, it was three bottle stores. It's about a kilometer away from where I was teaching, and news came out that Samora Machel had been killed, and everybody knew that the South Africans had done it. And I was confronted by a very drunk colleague calling me a South African spy. And a number of the other teachers defended me, but it was pretty tense for about a month. And it was sort of right at the front line. It was these were the front line states, and living it and to being able to be, you know, the color of your skin making you a spy. And it was, I'd always felt that or thought that, but this was the first time it actually hit me right in the. Mm. And it was, and so it, we actually talked, this colleague and I, about 6 months later about it, and we came to an understanding, and he just had this hatred for whites, which I I didn't understand at the time, but I completely do get it. And it was it was just a reaction that he had to when Samora Machel was killed. You remember, you know how Samora Machel was killed? Basically what they did was, is they had a beacon in Mozambique and the South Africans moved it. And so the planes fly by beacons, right? They get a signal and they moved it up into a mountain and the plane ran right into the mountain. Wow. And they proved that they did that. And so they didn't have to shoot it down. They didn't. And Samora Machel was the leader much farther ahead than Mugabe at that time. Mugabe sort of took over the quasi leadership of the frontline states after Samora Machel was killed. But it was Samora Machel. He was the liberation leader,
right,
who was standing up against the apartheid regime. So when I did come back to Canada, and I felt very privileged to be able to work for an organization that was, you know, Oxfam Canada at that time was a solidarity organization. We did development. But one of the first things I organized working with them as a volunteer to begin with was a conference called A Birth of a Nation, Namibia, Birth of a Nation, in 1990, which Walter McLean was at and a number of other people were at. And that is now 28 years ago. So I felt privileged. And then I went back, first time to South Africa. First time I'd ever been to South Africa was in 1990. And Mandela had been released. And I drove from our office. We had an office in Durban, and I drove from there across the country, the Transkei, Ciskei, and ended up in Cape Town. So I felt very privileged to be able to work with a lot of these organizations within South Africa. And it was a lot of that debate within Canada plays itself out in the anti-apartheid network.
In what way?
There was differing opinions on how to combat apartheid. And you'll hear that by talking to, whether it's the politicians, and it's too bad Flora McDonald's not alive anymore, but people like Walter McLean, you had the politicians on one side. And then you had the NGOs and civil society and the churches. And by the time the late 80s and early 90s came about, there was started to be some cracks within the anti-apartheid about strategy, not about that it's right or wrong, but how can Canada best support it? So there was a lot of lobbying with the anti-apartheid network, with the Canadian government, which I think was very successful, which we supported them in their fight with the British. But then the cracks started coming about, what do you do on the ground? Do you stay outside and just criticize and you know, in a sense, lobby? Or do you actually support organizations on the ground inside? And there was a split on that. And Oxfam Canada decided in the late 80s to actually go into the country and to fund the MDM at that time and different advice centers and different organizations around anti-apartheid work. Because even at that time, there was a split within the ANC about whether, you know, the outsiders and the insiders. And in many ways, the interesting thing is that that divide politically about whether you are outside or inside in the ANC is still playing itself out today. So we're 2018, and the debate between Jacob Zuma and Cyril Ramaphosa, a lot of that is outside-inside politics.
Right.
You know, the big debate about, we were in the country, we were at the coal face of the Caspers and all of that, and then you guys were all sitting in Lusaka. So there was that debate, and we, in a sense, there was, I remember one of the conversations about Oxfam, I myself didn't, but David Gallagher did, meeting with Thabo Mbeki in Lusaka, and them saying, okay, if you've got resources, then you should just give it to us. And Oxfam said, no, right? And there were Canadian NGOs that funded the ANC directly. Mm. And that debate about funding inside, Oxfam was on that side, to go into the country and to fund women's organizations, unions, civil society.
Right.
And I think it proved to be the right strategy at the end of the day.
But Oxfam had supported the ANC previously as well,
supported.
Right? Supported. So can you maybe get into that, the details of that a bit? There's a distinction here.
There is a distinction. And this is a little bit before my time. And the interesting thing, I think, about, maybe just to digress just a little bit, is what happened at that time probably couldn't happen today. They would be called a terrorist organization. So the whole landscape has changed. And a lot of people, even discussing this through an oral history or writing it down, is a tricky situation for an international NGO. Because if it you came out that you were actually funding a political party or the military wing, Okonkwo Siswe, of the ANC, that your donor dollars actually ended up in Okonkwo Siswe's hands and buying AK-47s, that's a major scandal. At that time, the best I can say is that I would argue, I don't think any Oxfam funds actually went to that. There were supporting, they did support the liberation movements. Exactly how that money was spent, you'd probably have to ask the ANC that. And there was probably never going to be a paper trail about that. We're not just talking the ANC and the PAC. We're talking SWAPO and ZANU and ZAPU and FELIMO and all of them. And you learned, I think, quite, and maybe some later than others, that civil society funds civil society, and that governments, once a government becomes, once a liberation movement becomes government, they're a government, and therefore they should get support from governments. And certain NGOs and civil society in Canada, we're talking churches too here, right? So it's not just, so you get very progressive churches funding liberation movements and funding, then funding the government. And I think they learn very quickly that that should stop.
Funding the government once the liberation movement has
And they would come and say, you fund the, you can fund the women's part of the, or the women's, you know, organization. And they, and some did, and for a certain period of time, and then stopped. But that's where that line is between the liberation movement and the government, and when the train leaves the station, and what is the role of civil society? You know, is to be a watchdog of government, that's our role in Canada, and civil society, and it should be in a place like Zimbabwe or South Africa as well. But that line was blurred, I think, around apartheid, but it was also blurred around Central America. I think it was blurred around, you know, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. And so there are places in the world where that line has been blurred. I don't think it's as blurred today, but at that time, it was blurred. And so when I started with Oxfam, which would have been 1990, I think in the 80s, late 80s, there were some funding to the ANC, but it was sort of general basket funding. It was done, I think, through Oxfam, CUSO, I think the Canadian Labour Congress, a couple of other NGOs, churches. But then most of that, I think, stopped in the early 90s, long before 1994. And especially, in particular, once Mandela was released and formal negotiations had started and CODESA started, that clearly Canadian NGOs and the anti-apartheid network were funding local organizations. Oxfam surely was. Like, we had two programs. We had the first, one of the first women's rights programs we started funding. It was 8 women's organizations in 1992, and it was a GAD program, back when it was called Gender and Development, as well as urban-based organizations around how municipalities and cities were going to be reorganized after the election. So that period of time when I started, the anti-apartheid network shifted, started changing, and changing its support because they could see there was a better end game. They could see where, well, some could see it. But there were divisions within the anti-apartheid, you know, there was a lot more, as I think in any movement, there's divisions within it. There's the more hard line. And there's always one of the most interesting things about movements, and I think the anti-apartheid network, was the influence of academics. Because academics are, not to paint them into, cannot always be the most practical. So they stand on a very high moral ground, and but so they were very critical of Oxfam going in and funding local organizations. And very interesting, you know, Susan was on the ground in South Africa at that time, and I think she'd be really, I hope she's actually doing one of these oral histories, because she would have been at the front of that debate about what should Canada's response be. And how much should it be lobbying and this, or is it a combination? So I found, just from a straight strategic point of view about how movements work, that in many ways they got it right. The anti-apartheid network and Canada's involvement in it was, I think, stellar.
What about debates around sanctions, especially 89, 90, 91? There was a push from the ANC at the time to maintain sanctions. Even when Mandela was released, they went into negotiations. But I know that there was some debate around whether or not you should start to lift sanctions to sort of reward the de Klerk government for making reform.
So I'll talk a little bit, I think, about sanctions. Sanctions were by far the most useful strategy. It was an easy thing to mobilize people in Canada around. You could sanction, you could, you know, divest, you could do all of these different things. They were very concrete. So the sanctions during the 80s, I think, were much more effective than sanctions today that are tried to being used, and they were used by, you know, on Zimbabwe in the 2000s. They still actually have them. And there's, you know, there is still as a tool, but and I think they cut their teeth on sanctions around South Africa. Mm-hmm. That was because it was really, really effective. And by far, the most effective sanctions were sports. South Africa is a sports-crazy country. And being kicked out of the Olympics and rugby and cricket and all of that was absolutely paramount. It was so important. And so there was debate after 1990. But not within the anti-apartheid network. Most, I think everybody was just, no, keep them on. Full throttle. They've worked until we have something signed and ready to go. Absolutely not. 91, 92, no. It was pretty clear. Again, I would say the debates within Canada was that let's lay on more. And I think the debate was, no, there's enough. It's working. But we're not pulling them off. That's my memory of them, is that. But maybe I was more on that lefty side of it, and it was very effective. Nobody wanted to pull them off. As I said, I always loved the academics. We were actually saying, they would come up with creative new ones, right? Oh, in particular around academic, there was a lot of sanctions around that. So it was a very interesting moment and a study of what sanctions do and how effective they can be. And I could argue, I think people could argue that they were by far the most effective sanctions that, you know, in the use of it as an international tool.
And why do you think that was the case?
I think it's because, for lack of a better word, apartheid was black and white. It was so easy to see the right side of it. It was impossible to defend apartheid. Right? So if you use an example like the Tamil Tigers, say, and what, it's a lot blurrier. This was very clear. It was clear cut. The second was is that the sanctions worked, and they could demonstrate that they worked, that they really hated them. And so it was a simple idea that could be sold. You didn't have to, it wasn't, you know, vastly complicated politics. It was vastly complicated politics, but to sell it as an anti-apartheid thing was actually quite simple. It was just it was a good thing at the time, but it actually shows today in hindsight that we missed a lot of it, a lot of the politics and a lot of what really was going on, both around the frontline states as well as in South Africa. You know, what the route that they've taken post-independence, we supported that. Like these liberation movements turning into governments, they had complete reign to do whatever they wanted. And, you know, if you use an example of Zimbabwe, the atrocities that happened in Ngorongoro Kokorohundi in the, you know, from 82 to 84, international community just turned a blind eye to it because Mugabe was the savior of the, you know, and the leader of the frontline states. He massacred over 20,000 people and got away with it. It only came out basically 10 years later when the churches started scratching and started screaming and saying, this is what really happened. So that blind eye that we did there's some serious lessons to be learned about that. Nobody could have predicted that Zimbabwe would be where it is now, and nobody could predict where South Africa is now. But some of those authoritative tendencies were there and were overlooked.
Mm. Do you think that criticism was maybe overlooked because of how severe the situation was, or?
Absolutely, it was overlooked. But it was also, I think there was not a really good analysis about when a military liberation gets into power, why would they change? That question was never really asked. Is that a military structure is secretive. You follow rules and think it's not democratic. It's the last thing it is democratic. And so why were we surprised when these governments became extremely authoritative? It was only natural. That it would have been unnatural to not be, to turn after how many years of repression and being a military wing of ZANU or ZAPU or FELIMO to then become democratic overnight. It just, that would make no sense. But we didn't question that. And I think that in hindsight is something that can be learned, that liberation movements, military-led military, have a hard time transitioning into a civilian democratic government.
I'd like to ask you about what your impressions were of maybe the Friends of South Africa at the time, because they were making critiques of the ANC. They were pretty vocal in the 80s. I just wonder who you think were the strongest allies of South Africa in Canada at the time.
In Canada, well, the biggest politically, globally, would have been the Brits, you know, under Thatcher. And she stuck her heels in. And from a very right-wing, racist perspective, it was very clear that that's what it was. It was establishment. And the funny thing was is that there weren't a lot of defenders in Canada. Because the odd thing that happened was that by far the best government, Canadian government, against the South Africans were conservatives. So the Liberals after were not as good. Trudeau was not as good around South Africa as Mulroney was. It started with Diefenbaker. So the Conservatives had a very strong tradition. By far, the best foreign affairs minister that we had around South Africa and frontline state was Joe Clark, bar none. Nobody even knows who the other ones were because they didn't stand up. He truly believed in, so, and he therefore, I think, silenced any sort of right wing, because that's where it would come from. Any sort of support for South Africa would have come from the right wing. And it was silenced by the conservative government. Hmm. So in a sense, it was, and that, well, back to your previous point, that's what made it easy in Canada. What made it so, sorry to use the word, black and white. Hmm. Because there was never any counter-protests. There was never, you know, even 20 people stand. They were smart enough to come out of the woodwork. I'm sure there was white South Africans living in Canada, but most of the white South Africans were the ones who ran away. There's a lot of support, in particular, in rural places in Canada. A lot of doctors, white doctors and that, they still were the only doctors that went to some of these rural places in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta. It's just, you were talking about the 70s and the 80s, right? They just picked up their families and came to Canada because they were fed up with apartheid. So there wasn't a constituency in Canada, but there was a constituency in Britain. Almost very different than there was a sort of a constituency, a white constituency around Zimbabwe. You know, in Zimbabwe, all hell broke loose around the land, invasions and that. They could tap into something, and they could tap into it in Canada, and they could tap into it internationally. There just wasn't that. There was no... you might have found it in Australia, but I think, again, I think that was just because they wanted to play cricket and rugby against them, not because of any sort of political thing and agreeing with apartheid. Because I think the interesting thing about apartheid is that it really... I've done a lot of thinking on this, about the one colonial power that had no place to go. The Afrikaners could not go back to the Netherlands. They had no connections anymore. All the Brits could get up and leave. So the whites were divided. And the Afrikaners are white Africans. They really have no ties. And they're the only colonial power, maybe other than the Spanish that ended up going to South America, that completely broke all their ties back to Spain. But the Afrikaners really had nowhere to go. And so that made for a different... They didn't have an international constituency to fight for them. The one they didn't want it, but two, they just didn't... Mm-hmm. There wasn't... The Netherlands weren't sitting there defending. They were one of the strongest anti-apartheid. They were ashamed of their colonial history that they actually were doing this. Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to Oxfam again, and when you were there, the coalition work that Oxfam would have been doing with other actors in the anti-apartheid network, can you tell me more about that?
It was, in a sense, it was, I knew of basically two. There was TICLSAC, which is the Toronto Committee for the Liberation of Southern Africa, and then you had SIDMA, the French equivalent, which was the Centre d'Information de Mozambique et Afrique Australe, based out of Montreal, and who I'm surprised is not here, who is a guy named Pierre Baudet. So you had the French and the English, so you had one out of Toronto and thing, and then you had little subgroups in Vancouver and in Halifax. A lot of times those were groups, but also usually coalescing around universities or around professors. But then Oxfam became a part of this, and most of the TICLSAC was started with academics and then moved outwards, where SIDMA started mostly with development organizations. And SIDMA was a development organization. It was actually its own organization. Mm-hmm. And then they brought in the Quebec unions and the churches, CCODP. And so then the churches started getting involved with TICLSAC and then the NGOs. And so when I was involved, it was, you'd sit around a table And there was basically two types of meetings. One was around strategy, you know, and meeting with the Canadian government. So it was around lobbying. And you probably heard a name mentioned, Lucy Edwards. She was one of the key people in the government. She was the bureaucrat, not an elected politician like Walter. So there was that side, lobbying the Canadian government with people like Linda Freeman. Then you had the NGOs that would meet, the Oxfams, the CUSOs, the SIDMAs, and lobbying the Canadian government for resources to fund, whether it was outside or inside, and whether it was frontline state stuff or actually after 1990, a lot of money started going into the country. Then it started to get organized under CCIC, Canadian Council for International Cooperation. And a lot of that was the development with the churches, and projects were starting to be funded. And at that time was also Partnership Africa Canada. And right up into and through the elections. So we got money from the Canadian government to send 25 observers to the elections in 1994, which I organized. And we went right into KwaZulu-Natal in four different areas. So that divide between the development side and the political side, I think probably happened in the late 80s and then right through until 1998, where in a sense, even actually after 94, the Canadian government abandoned civil society. They just cut us loose and said, we're going to give money directly to the government. Don't completely agree with it. But it was a funny thing that after 94, it went back to the normal way NGOs deal with the government, mm-hmm. where before it was very much, it wasn't really even lobbying. It was more strategizing. They were completely on board, mm-hmm. both politically and the administration side, the CETA and the foreign affairs side were completely on board. So it was like a sharing of minds, mm-hmm. which really hasn't happened since, I would argue. We were not adversarial. I think Linda would probably disagree a bit that there was a lot of flip-flopping at a political level, and I don't disagree with her on that. But on a cooperation level, it was quite astounding, actually. You could revisit it, probably it would maybe similar to Nicaragua later and probably Zimbabwe later, and there's probably some other examples when countries become independent that Canada became quite involved. Namibia was another one. But that cooperation was because of the political work that was happening with the anti-apartheid network. And back to the idea that we were on the same page. Mm-hmm. It was more about the levels and strategy. That was where the differences came. It wasn't like, you know, there was people in the Canadian government that thought that apartheid was okay. If they did, they didn't say anything. But it was, again, it's back to strategy. How do you actually... how do you achieve that goal? That was really bleak. You go back to 1988, as I said, I would have never thought it was even going to be in my lifetime. It happened real quick, a lot faster than... And it wasn't that Mandela got released. Mandela got released and the violence was just as bad. It didn't... The violence was continuing it right up until the election. The KwaZulu-Natal, where we were monitoring the election, was a war zone with Gachibutalese, and it was nasty stuff. And it was just his legacy. And so nobody could have predicted in the late 80s that it was going to be 1994. And so therefore the strategy of the Canadian government and the anti-apartheid network was always long-term.
What do you think was it? Why did it happen so soon? What changed?
I'll give you one theory. I think de Klerk's government, not just de Klerk, trusted Mandela. I really believe that it usually big man politics is a nasty thing. And the only person I can think of who didn't turn that way was Mandela. He was he was cutthroat. He was extremely very political and very hard-nosed, but he was trusted. And I think the Afrikaners trusted him. And I heard that even years later, that this is the guy that can actually give us a deal. He can, and he's the only one who can. And if we don't take this now, we're into another bloodbath. So the worst thing that was happening with the Africa, the government, was that they were fighting two wars on two fronts. They were fighting one in Angola. And so young people like yourself, who were in the army for 3 years, were either dying in southern Angola or in the townships. And these townships were getting nasty. It was really, really hard. And it was a full outright war. And there was no end in sight. They could have fought it. And I think they saw an out. And the out was Mandela. He could deliver it. And I heard that later, that the many years later, and that was the one guy that they trusted. And that might be simple. I don't, yeah. And you know, and I or you know, simplistic. But he could deliver. They also knew that they trusted him enough to deliver. If they gave him the thing, he could do it.
I want to ask you one more question about your impression of maybe sort of the NGO community today, because it seems to me that it is striking the history, as we mentioned, Oxfam and others working very closely with the government, also supporting openly liberation movements engaged in armed struggle. It seems to me that the situation has changed. Would I be correct in that?
Completely changed. I would say that again, maybe it's simplistic. I think 9/11 changed everything. All of a sudden, people became terrorists. So liberation movements, I can use as I used before, Tamil Tigers all of a sudden became terrorists instead of they were liberation. You might not completely agree with their. And I think the ANC in today's world would have classified as terrorists. They were by, one of the stories that goes is that the one country in the world that amnesty is not appreciated in is in South Africa. They labeled Mandela a terrorist. And didn't stop that until 1990, 91. So amnesty in South Africa is irrelevant. They don't want them there. They have nothing to do with it. And it's because, so the world today is a very different place. And I know that for the 25 years I worked for Oxfam, one of the things I spoke about quite a bit, and since I've left, is with David and Mayor Brownstone, a number of people within Oxfam, is writing a history of Oxfam and writing a history of this. And I actually don't think it could be published because of the scandal that's going on now. It's a different scandal. It's a sexual scandal and all of the buying of sex workers and all of that. But the world, the way it is now, is that organizations, if they were funding what the government classified as a terrorist organization, their charity status would be taken away. They'd be shut down. And I can use a story where it came across. I was in Zimbabwe. This would have been 2012, I think. And a story came across the line where there was some food. There was this thing in Canada called the Cross-Border Coalition that came in from southern Sudan into Eritrea during the war. And Oxfam and coalition churches and everything was bringing food across. Canadian. It was very similar to the anti-apartheid. Mm-hmm. Bringing food into, because they're being starved out, Eritrea and Tigray were being starved out by Mengistu and the Ethiopian government. And they found out later, this was 15 years later, that there was guns in that food. Oxfam and the coalition, they never funded that. I know that for a fact. But the rebels used it, used the food. And if that would have been found out today, we'd be hung. Canadian NGOs cannot, they have no ability to be, they have to be impartial. And I just actually don't agree with that. Like this idea, it's the same thing as journalists have to all be, you know, it's a falsehood. You pick sides. Development is all about choosing. You choose which villages you're going to work in, within a country, which part of the country you're going to work in. You pick which organizations you're going to work with. It's all choices. And the choices that, today the choices are less. And if you cannot choose the same choice, make the same decisions we made 30 years ago, we'd be shut down. People think, oh yeah, Oxfam was, you know, really very radical or something like that. No, we're talking church coalitions, which included all the mainline churches, were funding exactly the same thing that Oxfam was doing. What the previous conservative government did, they shut down the church network for doing one-tenth the amount of stuff they did 20 years earlier. So the environment we live in now is, there's no way Canadian NGOs could do what we did. For just example, like the laws came in around, you're not allowed to do more than 10% advocacy. Well, I'm sorry, Oxfam was, at that time, anti-apartheid, was probably doing 50% advocacy. So the rules governing NGOs have changed. And the interesting thing is that Canada was a lot more lapsed, where Britain wasn't. The Britain at that time, there was big fights within both the churches, Oxfam, Save the Children, all the different ones that had, you know, UK-based same organizations in Canada. The Charity Commission in Britain tried to shut down Oxfam, tried to shut down for speaking out against being part. They were not allowed to be a part of the anti-apartheid network in Britain because Margaret Thatcher tried to shut them down for it. So in a sense, Britain at that time was the way it is today. That the rules and regulations for NGOs to fund a liberation movement don't exist. I think they'd just be. And as I said, I think it comes from the term of calling them terrorists. And I think most of that comes from 9/11, is the redefining what a liberation, like what's the difference between, Samora Machel was a terrorist to certain people, to South Africans he was, to the British he was. And in today's world, that's what everybody is. If you take up an arms, any arms to try and change your society, you're a terrorist.
Right.
And I think you tied it up very well, is because I think the way society is now is a very interesting comparison to what it was then.
Mm-hmm.
This was an interview with Jim McKinnon, conducted by Michael Buechert on February 28th, 2018 at Carleton University, as part of the Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project.